Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative 2011 annual meeting. Our speaker is Barbara Means, Director for the Center for Technology and Learning for SRI International. The session is entitled Blended Learning Designs, a Learning Science Perspective.
The Center for Technology and Learning at SRI International performs research and development in the area of innovations in teaching and learning. That's really what we're all about. And so I want to bring that researcher's perspective to some of the issues that are confronting you as you're thinking about online learning in your institutions. So basically, in this talk, I'm going to first talk about a meta-analysis that we performed for the U.S. Department of Education, looking at the learning effects of online learning. And then I'll discuss some variations in blended learning strategies. And after taking some questions on those parts, I want to talk about some learning science principles that come out of research in general, but then in the context of applying them to the design and implementation of blended learning with some examples to the extent that we have time. So first, the meta-analysis. I need to acknowledge my co-authors, Yuki Toyama, Robert Murphy, Marianne Bakia, and Carla Jones, my colleagues at SRI. And this was a major undertaking done to really update the research on how effective is. It used to be called distance learning and include a lot of things like video conferencing. But we wanted to narrow in on the web era. So how effective in terms of student learning outcomes is online learning? That was really what motivated this piece of research. And we did an exhaustive search for studies of online learning from 1996 through July of 2008, so 11 and a half years worth of studies, looking for cases where either a fully online or a partially online, that is a blended learning treatment, was contrasted with face-to-face or conventional learning. So that's what we went about doing. Now, we had a little bit different inclusion criteria than some of the previous meta-analyses that you may have seen, including those that came up with no significant difference. One obvious difference is we started at a date that was post the World Wide Web in order to have more recent studies and not have the noise from earlier technologies in there. But we had four criteria that it's important to keep in mind. I mentioned that it had to have either a fully online or a blended condition contrasted with a face-to-face instructional condition. It had to be about student learning outcomes, not student perspective, student attitude, student attendance, but a learning outcome that was objectively measured and where the same measure was used both for the treatment group and the control group. It had to have a reasonably rigorous design. So it either had to be an experimental design where students or classes were randomly assigned to either the online or the control condition, or it could be a quasi-experiment where it wasn't random assignment as long as some kind of pre-measure of student achievement level was taken and outcomes were statistically controlled for that pre-measure, or we could statistically control them. And then finally, it had to include enough information that we could compute what is called an effect size. And that is just simply the difference between the mean performance of the treatment group minus the control group divided by the standard deviation. So it's in standard deviation units, and that's all that that means. When we went through electronic databases, distance education journals, online learning and virtual learning journals, previous meta-analyses to find articles that might be appropriate, we identified 11,032 tentatively appropriate pieces of empirical research. But when we had analysts go through those with those four criteria in mind that I talked about, it turned out that we could only find out of that 1,132 articles only 99 of them measured student learning objectively in an experimental or quasi-experimental design. So evidence may be overrated, but we have so little of it. It's one thing we have to face. And then when we look more closely at these, only 45 of them contained the information needed to compute effect sizes. And some studies, however, included several experiments or several contrasts. So we were able to get 50 contrasts, that is, differences between treatment and control group, from the 45 studies, which was enough to do a meta-analysis. But for almost 12 years of research on what is arguably one of the biggest changes in the way we do instruction, it really isn't much of a harvest. The main finding, and the thing that got the most attention, was contrary to some earlier meta-analyses on distance learning, what we found is that across all of the 50 effects, the average effect size was plus 0.20, which is not huge, but it's statistically significant, and it favored the online treatments over the control. So they were actually, on average, better. But we need to look a little more deeply into what this means. The characteristics of the studies that were in this corpus that we were able to find, they were about evenly split between those that involved college students or younger. 5 of the 45 involved either secondary school or middle school. And then there were about 15 to 17 that were college. And then the others were graduate school, or professional training. So it was largely learners over 18. In the individual studies, the average learner age varied from 13 to 44, quite a span. Nearly all of them involved formal education. So there were very few that were informal, I think maybe one or two. The most common subject area that was being taught was medical or health care. And I think that's not because there's more online learning in medicine than in other fields necessarily, although there may have been during this time period. But I do think there is a greater tradition of experimentation and rigorous research in the medical fields and in the institutions that provide medical education. So that's my conjecture, at least. Sample sizes ranged from 16 to 1,857 students, but only 5 of the studies had 400 students or more. So most of them weren't huge. Although the individual studies weren't necessarily large, putting them all together then gives us a way to look across studies and find effects that the individual studies might have been too small to find. 19 of the studies involved time frames of less than a month, but the majority were longer. Now, when we designed the study, although we were first going to look at all of those 50 contrasts together, we always had in mind that we would look at purely online learning and blended learning separately. We planned that from the outset, and the reason was, from a standpoint of policy or practice, it seemed to us that there are really different criteria in terms of effectiveness a decision maker would have. So if you're contrasting purely online learning with face-to-face instruction, and they are equivalent, not significantly different, that would give you a rationale for adopting online learning, not only when there's no other option, which is where it's been popular in rural areas and so on, where it first kind of got its feet, but also in cases where there were cost savings that attended it. So you would have a rationale for doing that. When it comes to blended learning, however, that combines online and classroom instruction, that's not necessarily less expensive, and in fact, it's probably usually more expensive. So if you were going to invest in that, you would want to see evidence that it was in fact more effective than conventional purely face-to-face instruction before you'd put that investment in development and delivery of blended learning. So we felt it was important to break these two things apart. And we divided the 50 effects into those that were pure online learning versus control and those that were blended learning versus control. When we did that, it was about half and half. Interestingly enough, the pure online learning versus control had a slight edge, 0.05 of a standard deviation, but it was not statistically significant anymore. So it lost by itself. The purely online learning was as good as, but not better than, normal classroom-based instruction. But the mean effect for the 23 contrasts between blended learning and conventional instruction was 0.35, favoring the blended learning. And that was very statistically significant, less than 1 out of a 10,000 chance that you found a difference that big on average just by chance, just because of your sampling of studies. So that tells us that there is something there that at least in the kinds of conditions that are contrasted in the research that we find more positive learning outcomes for blended learning. So then we looked at the individual effect sizes for individual studies to see if they varied a lot, and they did. So this is across all 50 again, from minus 0.80, that's where the control condition was better, to plus 1.11, which is a pretty whopping difference in educational research. So this suggests that there's something going on here other than just the medium going online. I want to mention a lot of people have used these data in proposals and in arguing to their institutions around online learning. And we actually, after the original report was published and posted on the Department of Education website, which you see up there, ed.gov, we found some mistakes in the coding of some of the studies and actually a bug in the statistical programming, statistical software that does the meta-analysis, which we subsequently fixed and reposted. So if you are quoting any numbers, please get the 2010 revision of the report, which is available online, so you'll have the right numbers. So finding that variation across the different studies, that led us to do what's called an analysis of moderator variables. So that means we started snooping within the data. What is it that might have caused, you know, big advantages for online learning in some studies, small or no advantages in other studies? And so we had coded these studies on some 50 other features. Some were features of the context, like the date it was published or the kind of students. Some were features of the nature of the content being taught. Some were study design features. And some were, and probably of most interest to our question about how to do blended learning based on research, what's research-based best practices, some were practices that were incorporated into the study. So trying to get research-based clues as to how we should design blended or online learning. When we did this, moderator variable analysis essentially is the same as testing for an interaction. So to see, is it a case that online learning or that blended learning is more effective than conventional, say, for medical and health students, but not for students in other kinds of courses? Or is it more effective if you have online quizzes, but not if you don't have online quizzes? Or is it more effective if you have synchronous communication with peers, but not if you don't have synchronous communication with peers? Well, we tested all of those variables and more. And there were actually relatively few practices that emerged as statistically predicting the size of the online learning effect. And I'm going to talk about those that did briefly. One thing that we coded was we looked at the description of the instruction for the online condition, and we coded it as being either independent, that's where students really work on their own with software, instructor-led, where there's a lot of instructor guidance or an online instructor who's kind of working with students through it, and collaborative, where a lot of the learning is emergent from students working with other students and the instructor online. So it's much more emergent as it goes along. The direction of it changes depending on what the students do in the course of the instruction. And it turned out that there was an effect of this variable of instructional model, and that the learning that was completely independent had smaller effects. Online learning that's completely independent has less of an advantage than online learning that's either instructor-led or collaborative. It's kind of a mouthful if you can get around it, but there were three categories, and one of them was less effective than the other two. We also coded studies as to whether the content of instruction and the instructional approach seemed to be alike or very close to each other in the online and the control condition. And not too surprisingly, if they were very much alike, there tended not to be an advantage for the online instruction. So the cases where you saw the advantage for the online instruction, which we know was mostly in blended instruction, was where there was a difference. There were different kinds of activities, different kind of content going on in the blended learning condition. And then, although it didn't quite attain statistical significance, it was very close, and I think with a few more research studies, it would go over the line. There was a tendency for those studies that we coded where the online students were spending more time. We could tell from the write-up that they were actually spending more time with the content than the kids in the conventional class. Those were ones where, again, we saw larger effect sizes. So one important thing about this is, and it's important in talking about these results, is that when you see all these differences that were between the conditions in these studies where we saw advantages for the experimental group, there were a lot of things going on. It's not just that part of the instruction was online. And taken as a whole, I think the reasonable interpretation is that the observed advantage of blended learning is a product of redesigning the learning experience, not just of the fact that you put it online. I was on a radio NPR talk show, actually, after the report was released, shortly after it released, and I got a call, or one of the call-ins, and it was a community college instructor who said, "Well, I put my PowerPoints online, and it didn't make any difference." And I wanted to say, oh, no surprise there. So you have to do more than just put the class notes or the PowerPoints online to get the kinds of effects we saw in these studies. So what are some of the implications for practice? Well, we talked about the advantage of blended learning. It also seems to be, as I said, that it's really that additional kind of learning resources, the opportunity to redesign it to do a better job that produces the better outcome. And it also looks like having some form of teacher and other student involvement is really important. I think those are a couple of things we can take from this research about design. Now, the outcomes of the meta-analysis seem to make a lot of sense post hoc to a lot of people. Initially, they thought there wouldn't be any difference. But post hoc, they say, well, that makes sense. It's the best of both worlds. And at some level, I think that's right. The gut response is a good one. But if you start pushing on that a little bit and trying to think about it a little more deeply, we don't really know what that means. I mean, certainly online systems and classroom instructors, at least potentially, both have a lot to offer. But we don't really have a good sense of what the best role is for the instructor versus what is online. So we need more information, and that's kind of where I've been starting to think recently. So let me just find out what I did with the cursor. Okay. In the course of searching the literature, we also found studies that didn't have a face-to-face condition but contrasted a couple of online or blended variations with each other. So we didn't put those in our meta-analysis because how could you say which was the control group? This one used video and this one used chat. Well, which is the experimental and which is the control group? But we did go and look at those and do a narrative synthesis of them, so it's a more qualitative synthesis. And there are a few more, I think, prescriptions for practice that come out of that. One of the things we saw that studies that added additional media, So adding video or adding graphics or animation that didn't provide more information, same amount of information, just more media, did not show any difference between the more and fewer media in terms of student learning outcomes. But on the other hand, giving learners an element of control over their media, that is, giving them the option for replaying something, for accessing what they want to access, for having online tools to support them if they need the support, that did seem to be effective. Individualizing learning content where those students who have shown that they already appear to know something can go on to the next thing, and those students who need some background knowledge that maybe was supposed to be in the last course but they didn't get is provided to them, that appears to improve student learning outcomes. Incorporating multiple choice online quizzes, the kind I find in all of the mandatory training I have to take as a manager, does not increase learning outcomes in the absence of prompts for reflection or individualization. On the other hand, prompts for self-reflection and monitoring of one's understanding do appear to have positive effects in the literature. And training in the kind of metacognitive skills Candace Teal was talking about also seems to have a positive effect. Now, Robert Bernard and his colleagues at Concordia University, who do many meta-analyses, it's really their specialty, pulled together really much of the same research. But they looked at it a little bit different way. They wanted to look at different versions of online learning. And instead of doing a qualitative synthesis of research the way we did, what they decided to do was to use researcher coding of their judgment of the degree of interactivity in the two conditions in the study as they were described. So they would, for example, look at the amount of student-teacher interaction described in the two conditions and decide which one had more, and whichever one had more, they would say that was the experimental condition. And what that means is that a particular treatment that might be like having a discussion board might be the experimental condition in one study, but they would have counted it as the control condition in a different study because it was contrasted with something that had more interaction. So it was a different way of doing a meta-analysis than I'd seen before, but it turned out some pretty sensible and coherent results. And what they found essentially is that the size of the online learning effect is larger when any of the three kinds of interaction they coded increases. So if there's more student-teacher interaction, larger effects. More student-student interaction, larger effects. And especially more student-content interaction, larger effects. That was the biggest single predictor of how large that online learning advantage would be, is the extent to which the students are involved with the content you're worried about learning about. Now, that was for the student learning outcomes. They also looked at student affective outcomes. That's when, you know, the smiley test, you ask the students how they liked it. And interestingly, it was the amount of student-student interaction that best predicted the smiley faces. So students like it more when there's more student-student interaction. So I think I'll stop there for a minute. That's the part, kind of the heavy-duty research meta-analysis part, and I'd like to see if there's some questions either from the audience or from those online before I go on and start talking about blended learning designs and some learning science principles. Looks like I have one.
Yes. Basically, I want to see if you can make this inference. You showed that, or you detected that purely online is not significantly different than the control, and that hybrid instruction is better than control, a little bit. Can you make any inference from that about saying, is hybrid better than purely online? In other words, is the interaction with the faculty member a real human? Is there any value added to that?
Yes. I think you can make that inference. I have to be a little tentative about it. There are some studies that have contrasted those two things in the same study and haven't found a significant difference. But I think if you look at the effect sizes for the individual studies, it's really pretty compelling that we're looking at a different distribution when we look at the hybrid or blended studies, and that it is one that moves the student learning further in the direction we'd like it to go. And so I think that's an argument for using blended instruction and not just purely online. Now, there are lots of other perspectives depending on your institution, of course, cost control being one that's prominent in many places right now. Any other questions?
It's just a comment, actually, about the Bernard study. I tend not to believe the finding about the student-content interaction being the most important factor, because I suspect that it's confounded with a pedagogy that's aimed at content recall because it's so important in typical classes. Mm-hmm. If you look generally at education mm-hmm. research, that's not what you would find. You'd find that the interaction effects, you know, for example, some of the kinds of things that were talked about in the keynote mm-hmm. yesterday mm-hmm. are pretty powerful in a lot of courses, and we have no reason to believe that learning theory is any different when you're in mediated environments. So when you begin to see a finding from a mediated environment that looks like it conflicts with what you generally know about learning, it's probably something that's fishy about the mediated study.
Yeah, well, I would say that, you know, generally about learning, more interaction with content, more interaction with the content that you're assessing produces better outcomes on what you assess.
Yes.
And the problem is with the assessment.
Exactly.
So if you're assessing trivial content, then more interaction with the trivial content you're going to assess will improve that assessment. If you are assessing conceptual understanding, then more interaction with the concepts will improve the outcomes. So I agree with your concern that we have to look at the nature of the assessments in order to judge how we weigh this research.
Yeah, I'm sure that there's not much of this around, but I suspect that in the longer term, studies that are sort of in two parts, one of which says, here's a teaching and learning activity, how effective is it? And then the other part is, for this activity, in what ways is it easier and more productive to do it in this kind of facility or environment versus that? So the effect of the medium is on what it is that the teacher is able to do, and especially, obviously, what the student is able to do and does do. And then you look quite separately at, all right, given that they do that, what's the outcome of that activity?
Right. I think we need that kind of research. Yeah, a lot of what we have now, there are a lot of descriptive studies that describe instructors' self-reports of what they're able to do. For example, in the blended learning environment than they were able to do before having the online component. The problem is that they rarely have objective measures of what the teacher was able to do. And that's the next step, where we really have objective measures differentiating some of these instructional design features in the online and the face-to-face context. Mm-hmm.
What differences, if any, would you expect to see between the K through 12 versus higher ed? And do you control for that here? And how much does that affect this study?
Oh, good question. And that was of a lot of interest to our sponsors, the U.S. Department of Education, because they really cared about K-12 education. That's their mission. And actually, we first did the search of the literature for just 10 years. We did a decade and found no published controlled studies of K-12 online learning effectiveness with objective measures. None. And they were appalled. And then what we ended up doing is waiting 18 months. And interestingly enough, the additional 18 months greatly increased our corpus that we could analyze and turned up five K-12 studies. We looked carefully at those studies because that's what really interested our sponsor. And partly this is I don't want to say anomaly, it's the way statistics work. So when we tested whether age made a difference in the size of the effect, we got no effect. So it was not a significant moderator. So I think the strongest you could say from all the data we have is that we would expect similar kinds of outcomes with younger students. However, when you looked at each individual study of the five, they were more mixed for the K-12 than they were for the higher education. And I think as that research corpus grows, again, it's another effect that right now the best evidence we have suggests that the same kinds of principles hold, but it may turn out that it's a rather different story. And I'm going to talk about some of the different features of blended learning and things that would play out differently in the K-12 and higher ed environment.
Excuse me, I apologize if I missed that at the beginning of your talk, but I'm a little confused about your definition of blended learning.
Mm-hmm.
I would say some of those typical designs are more of web-enabled courses where the face-to-face lecture was the same. Mm-hmm. Could you define that?
Yeah, in our meta-analysis, we used objective, something that was easy to code. And so what we said was it had to have, it had to use both the face-to-face and the online medium, and whichever one was the smaller portion of the time had to be at least 25%. So it was purely a kind of quantitative classification. Now, I noticed recently Bill Tucker has defined blended learning as saying that the online portion needs to include an element of student choice over the time, place, path of learning, which would perhaps take out some of the instantiations of these, although I think all of them could come under his definition depending on how they're implemented. Does that help? Any other questions? Okay. Well, so part of what makes it difficult to derive research-based best practices for blended learning is that there's so many versions, so many things people call blended or hybrid learning. And I just talked about how we defined it for a meta-analysis, which was my next point. And then, of course, the way it's staffed can be different, too. So you can have the official teacher in the classroom with an automated instruction online. You could have the same official teacher in the classroom and online. You could have one teacher in the classroom and a different teacher online. You could have the official teacher online and an aide or assistant, a graduate teaching assistant in the classroom or computer lab, and vice versa, so et cetera, et cetera. Google, in fact, their head of education told me, they've defined 27 different learning arrangements that they use for their staff development. So there are an infinite number of varieties and ways that you can do this, which makes it more complicated. So what I want to spend a little time talking about is some of the features of difference here. I think it's really important, as some of you have pointed out, to keep in mind the student characteristics, what's the nature of the students we're talking about. We might have different principles for different kinds of students. What type of learning are we talking about? And then what's the nature of the instructor or the kind of in-class instruction that you're getting? So it's really difficult in this, given this complexity, it's unlikely we're going to have one set of best practices that apply in all cases. That's really the point of this slide. We've got three dimensions. And I would have had four if I knew how to draw a four-dimensional object. I would have put context in there as well. Well, I want you to think a little bit about the different kinds of learning, because our attempt to provide guidance to policymakers and designers with respect to blended learning needs to keep in mind just what those learning objectives are. We have a large research base showing that different kinds of conditions produce learning of different types, depending on what we're trying to do. So, for example, if you have an audience who has the conceptual background for what you're talking about, and you're trying to impart information or knowledge that's only moderately new, telling them is very efficient. It's hard to beat for the amount of information you can convey and the amount of time available. So unlike many speakers at conferences, I'm not going to apologize for talking at you on the assumption that you have the background knowledge to absorb the new information. On the other hand, the problem we have is often we assume that our students have that conceptual background when they don't. And often, either explicitly or implicitly, what we're really trying to get at is a deeper conceptual change. So we want to change the way students understand some rather difficult concept and change the associations between different concepts in their minds. Now, that really requires something that's much more complicated, as I'll talk about. And both of those are different from if we're trying to teach procedures or skills, where we really want to give a lot of practice with some feedback and some time press so they get automaticity. So if we're going after that deeper learning, it's important that we start where they are, we understand where our learners are, we provide cases where their existing concepts will not work, and it appears that having chances to address those cases with others with more advanced understanding, and that's a collaboration part, whether with an instructor, with a mentor, with peers, appears to help induce conceptual change. And then finally, I want to add the fourth kind of learning, which we now find actually activates different parts of the brain. And it's, I think, a renewed understanding of the importance of motivation and engagement. That's that affective response. And so that's something that we want to be able to also harness whatever kind of learning we're designing. It's helpful, especially for students who have struggled in the past, to have something that doesn't look like their past school experiences. Something that triggers curiosity appears to be good for all kinds of students, something that builds excitement and that offers satisfaction. So there are also, as we mentioned, different kinds of students: elementary, secondary, college, workplace, informal, advanced degree. With our high-achieving, strongly motivated students, almost anything seems to work. And I think we have good evidence of online learning working for them as well. It's really the struggling or credit recovery students that are a bigger challenge. And the question is, how do we design effective blended learning environments that work for these students? And we're just starting to build that kind of research base. And then, of course, I wanted to mention, you have to consider, what are you comparing the online or blended learning to? And it could be the kind of boring teacher you might remember from the movie. Anyone? Anyone remember the movie? Ferris Bueller's Day Off? Okay, so who asked about the Tariff Act, named after? What is it? Smoot Hawley? All right, you got it. Okay, well, that kind of teacher, it probably doesn't hurt to replace with a video of a world-class lecturer. But if you're talking about the kind of teacher that really gets in there and works with the student and is probing their understanding and supporting the student's inquiry, then you've really got a very different comparison. So these differences are enormous. So what do we know? I've compiled some things. This really comes from the learning science literature in general, the kind of thing that's in the National Academy of Sciences volume, How People Learn or Taking Science to School. It's for instruction generally, but I believe it's no less applicable when it comes to blended learning. And I'll give you an example of its application if we have time. One is analyzing the cognitive demands of what is to be learned. We heard a lot about that yesterday, doing a very careful job of that. And the problem is that for many, at higher education in particular, for many instructors, those cognitive demands are no longer demanding for them. They're not even aware of what principles and patterns they're using when they do something. So making those evident so that they can be part of the design is an important step. And then designing really coherent instructional sequences around them. We also heard, talked a little bit about motivation, having an authentic, exciting context for learning. We heard about the example of, I think it was arsenic poisoning in Bangladesh, for example, as being something that would make chemistry exciting. Eliciting students' thinking as a starting point. So that helps you understand, okay, these students are ready to receive information, but these other students are really going to need to do some conceptual work to get up to there. And then giving them opportunities to test their ideas and receive feedback and having collaborative activities that support that. So here's an example I'm going to try to use to illustrate some of these principles. This is actually from middle school, but you can do similar things, certainly at the higher education level, and I think you'll see some features that are similar to those that Candace Teel showed you earlier today for the Open Learning Initiative. This was done by Marsha Lin and her colleagues at University of California, Berkeley. It's called WISE, the Web Inquiry Science Environment. So it covers science. There are lots of different units at this point. It's been going on for years. And although it was originally designed for middle school, it's actually been used up through the college level, and it's used in a number of countries, the U.S., Canada, Scandinavia, and I don't remember where in Asia. And I'm going to use this to try to illustrate some of the principles I've been talking about. So it's a kind of skillful integration of in-person collaboration and online support that happens in WISE. Much of the online work in this case, and they started out doing this research in low-income schools in the Bay Area, and so many students at that time certainly did not have technology and online access at home. That was one of the considerations, but also because the teacher was to be part of this, a lot of the online work is done in the classroom by students working in pairs at the computer. And that not only means you need fewer laptops, but it also means that they're talking to each other and you have that pairing of the more and less knowledgeable student as they're collaborating. The teacher can hear their talk as well as seeing what they do online. So in terms of having that window into what students do and do not understand, this is a way to give a rich set of resources to the instructor. And then in conjunction with the online activities, there are classroom activities such as actually running experiments and doing debates. So one of the things they like to do is run debates around the scientific inquiry. They used controversies in science as a kind of centerpiece for this instructional design. So they would find something that people disagree about, and they actually took real scientific articles, things from Science Magazine and Science Journals. They had graduate students rewrite them in language that was accessible for middle school students, because if you've read them lately, you know it's pretty tough going. And then framed the controversies, like one of the early ones was whether the dwindling frog population in a particular area, I think it was Wisconsin, was an indicator of environmental degradation. And they had scientists saying yes, and here's my evidence, and scientists saying no, and here's my evidence. And they've gone on to a lot of other things like global warming and other controversies. Now, one of the things it does here is to scaffold or support that process of scientific inquiry, which is new for a lot of these students. So you can't see this very well, but WISE actually gives them an introduction. It gives them some knowledge, it gives them a context, a problem context, and then sets them to thinking about how they might investigate that particular controversy. And it might be through reading evidence from scientists, it might be through running experiments or doing both. The experiments are run sometimes in the classroom, in the real world. Sometimes they're actually run online and through simulations. So both kinds of experiments are run. So here's some more design principles. Simplify complexity in the early stages. So support some of the things that make it hard that are extraneous to the key concept you're trying to teach. But don't lose that key concept. Keep the core idea there. Give learners opportunities to plan, oversee, and reflect on their own learning. And then embed assessment into the online learning activities using different forms of assessment. These are some of the things that WISE does. Can't see them very well, but the first panel shows the kind of background and framing of the context it provides for a global climate change unit. The second panel on your right shows for students that need some help with certain words, they can click on them and go like glossary, get an explanation of those words, particularly important with new science terms and particularly for English language learners. And then WISE has a hint mechanism. We saw one on the OLI this morning. They have this Amanda the Panda who The kids can ask for hints at different levels, in much the way you see it done in the Carnegie Mellon work. WISE supports the knowledge construction through an idea manager that the kids keep for themselves that shows the connections between different pieces of evidence they have, say, to support their argument around the deformed frogs. So one of the things you might be thinking, and I would agree with you, is actually the design principles I've talked about are not really essentially something that's inherent in face-to-face or online learning. So it's not that you have to do it in a certain way. I don't think we're going to find one blended learning design that's best for every kind of learning or every combination of content, students, and instructors. I just don't think that would happen, even if we had enough research evidence. But I do think it's important in designing blended learning to look at those good instructional design principles and make sure they're put in place somewhere, whether it's in the classroom or online. And I think we also need to realize that technology does have some special affordances. That comes to individualizing instruction. It's much easier to be teaching different things to different students and keeping track of that when you have the technology support. Without it, certainly a high school teacher with 150 students in chemistry classes is not going to be able to do that. And also when it comes to assessing and keeping track of students' level of understanding, their proficiency in different areas, and really opening up that possibility that we saw this morning in Candace's talk to have much more detailed information about students' learning paths and diagnoses of what they know. So my example from higher education is usually the Open Learning Initiative, which I won't go through because you heard that this morning. I think it's one of the most impressive higher education applications I've seen. And what I'll just skip, you saw much of these this morning. What I wanted to focus in on is that use of formative assessment woven into the course. I think it's really important. So there are the interactive simulations that students can manipulate, and what they do is actually something that you can capture in the system. They also write in probes to get at why did you do what you did with the simulation, which gives instructors good information. Those did I get this quizzes, so students are testing themselves. It's not for their grade, it's for themselves. And then they do something I love because it's so easy. They have a question in at least one of their courses that says, what of this unit that you just did online, what was the muddiest point? What was the hardest thing to understand? Just ask your students, what are you having trouble understanding? And so they get information from that. And then they use essay questions as well. So the approach here, and I think the potential for all kinds of blended learning that can really be powerful, is having students do some of their work online, where we're really capturing this kind of information in the course of their online work in a way that's very seamless, that doesn't feel like a test, and yet is this rich set of information that you can have different kinds of data displays for either the student or for the instructor. The instructor can look at this at his or her leisure, and then really focusing in on those things that need to be focused in on with a particular class in class. So I think it gives us a potential for a great increase in effectiveness if we do this right. So just to summarize the whole thing, trying to apply those learning science principles to blended learning, and I tried to get it down less than 7 because that's about the limit of what people can remember. So first was analyze the cognitive demands of what's to be learned. And then think about engagement, the authentic motivating context, collaboration with peers. Embed assessment, use multiple assessment approaches. Make assessment of feedback available to the student as well as the instructor. Scaffold that student reflection on where they are. Provide face-to-face interaction with an instructor to address student questions. You know, really focus that. Think of the in-person time as a precious resource that needs to be used well. And use that online activity information to really make that in-person experience a more valuable one. So those are the principles I see from both the specific evidence around the meta-analysis of online learning, but also from the learning science research in general. And I'm sure we'll know a lot more 5 years from now as you continue your work and hopefully more of your institutions actually do the kind of rigorous research that will provide new insights. Thank you very much. We have a little bit of time for some more questions.
So I have a question that came in from Jim Julius, who's watching this online, and I think you spoke to this, but I'll go ahead and ask this on his behalf. And he says, so many of our faculty who do blended or online courses find themselves redesigning their in-person courses based on what they learn about course design. If the difference maker is course redesign, is there an implication that a well-redesigned, fully in-person course would be equivalent to a well-designed blended or online course in terms of learning outcomes?
Yeah, good question. I think it's certainly possible, and I think it wouldn't be hard to go out and find cases of that. But another advantage of the online learning that I neglected to mention and I should have is it's a natural for increasing learning time. And the way we structure education now, where we have, you know, if you're an instructor, you get the classroom for a certain number of minutes and you get the lab for a certain number of minutes. And really getting student interest and having the online resources available, I think, can extend the amount of time they spend learning. And that may be hard to compete with if you have a really well-designed blended course.
You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also search for EDUCAUSE on iTunes. Thanks for listening.